Hey, our Prestige TV podcast is killing it right now. Sunday nights, breaking down Euphoria, Joanna Robinson, Nora Princiati. Me and Joanna and Mallory Rubin, we broke down the Yellow Jackets season finale on Monday. That is up. Over an hour of theories and guesses and theories explained, all kinds of stuff. Really fun podcast. And then Joanna and Van Lathan on Wednesday are going to be breaking down Ozark, where we left off after the first three seasons, where we might be going for season four. Check it out, the Prestige TV podcast on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. It's the Bill Simmons podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sports book. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub, filtered by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting on the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same game parlays for every NBA game. Download the app today. Bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available and listen to the end of the episode for additional details. You must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Prime Video, where you can find all your live sports and docs in one app with one password. You can see the great G League documentary we made last summer. You can see Giannis, The Marvelous Journey. You can see the NWSL, all included with Prime. Plus, you can buy Premier Boxing or stream the NHL and NBA playoffs on Max with the Bleacher Report Sports add-on, or add Paramount Plus for the Masters on CBS. Prime Video. It's all your favorite sports in one place. Restrictions apply. Prime membership required for add-on subscriptions. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details. We're also brought to you by the Ringer Podcast Network. Put up a new rewatchables on Monday night. We did Miracle because the Winter Olympics is coming. Why wouldn't we? Me and Chris Ryan talked about that. Talked about great sports movie speeches of all time. Kurt Russell, top five films. What that night in 1980 meant for a little kid like myself at the time. But that really fun podcast. You can check that one out. We have a big movie coming next week on that one as well. Mentioned I was on the Prestige TV podcast on Monday, breaking down season one of Yellow Jackets if you missed it. And then what else do we have? FanDuel Sportsbook. We are going to be doing another same game NBA parlay on Wednesday. And then get ready for this weekend, Million Dollar Picks. We lost on our boost on last weekend, so I'm going to try to win that one back this week. And then finally, some news, launched a YouTube channel. We finally spun off all of my content from the Ringer's YouTube channel, which is like basically 6 years worth of stuff. We felt like we finally had enough non-me stuff on that Ringer channel that we could split them into two. So you can subscribe. It's youtube.com/Bill Simmons. It is 6 years of videos from my podcast, from the rewatchables, breakout stuff we did, little extra stuff, some special stuff. And then going forward, that's where we're going to be putting all of our videos and all of our breakouts from this podcast and from the rewatchables. Plus, we're going to try to do some at least a couple times, some exclusive videos on that channel as well. So as I say in the channel, there aren't a lot of over 50 people that have their own YouTube channel, but it made sense. It made sense for me. And also I am declaring war on all the other over 50 people. I want to be the top over 50 person on YouTube. It could be a noble goal for me. Anyway, check it out. YouTube.com/Bill Simmons. Coming up on this podcast, Raja Bell came on. We're talking about two coaches who are struggling through weird seasons for different reasons. Frank Vogel on the Lakers and Steve Nash for the Brooklyn Nets. We're talking about the ramifications of KD's injury and Cleveland and Memphis and a lot of the other NBA storylines as we head past the midway point. And then Joe House comes on. I have to fill out my all-star ballot by Friday, so I'm going over the preliminary picks with him. We talked a little about Kyler Murray, golf, and best food in the remaining NFL playoff cities. So that is all coming up. First, our friends from Pearl Jam. All right, Raja Bell is here. We're taping this. It is Tuesday morning Pacific time. Haven't had Raja on in a while. He is on The Real Ones. Is it The Real Ones or Real Ones?
I think it's Real Ones, yeah.
I think it is Real Ones. There's no The. It's no real ones. You and Logan Murdoch. You can hear them twice a week on the Ringer NBA show. You can also see Raja prowling the sidelines of Florida football and basketball games. doing parent coach stuff. Speaking of coaches. So Nets and Lakers, I want to talk about them through the prism of coaches. And okay. we'll start with our guy Nash, who takes this Nets job. And it's been one of the all-time soap operas, basically from the moment he showed up. He thought, this is great. I'm taking over this team with Durant still in his prime, come back from an injury. Kyrie, one of the top 20 players in the league. We have some assets. Maybe we make a trade. We're going to be contending for a while here. And his top three guys, I think, have played 16 games together total. He's had injuries. He's had the Kyrie COVID saga, which is ongoing. And then finally, Durant breaks down last week. He's got this weird roster with all these kind of guys past their prime. Rookies not ready to play yet. Guys on two-way contracts. You're trying to navigate anything. And then the pressure of just being one of the league's signature teams. How worried should we be about our guy Nash? Because he seems okay in the sidelines from like a stress standpoint. Remember when Obama, like by 2012, all of a sudden his hair was white? I haven't seen that with Nash yet, but it feels like we're heading there. This was stressful, Raja.
Yeah, this is stressful. I've said this before, Bill. I felt sorry for Steve, a lot. And I would say that he's uniquely qualified to handle what's going on there because if you know him like I know him, like he's always optimistic. There's always this sense of, that's why he's such a great leader, right? Like, it's gonna be fine. Like, we'll figure it out, and we'll let our culture just be the guiding light, and as long as we're in line with that, things are gonna work out. He's got this great way about him. But man, you need some help, and some of the cards he's been dealt with the team, with the concessions made for certain players on the team, with the inconsistencies of availability. And I mean, it's really just hard to establish culture in that environment, right? So even if you were this great establisher of culture and your culture could, guide you guys as a North Star through all of these dark times, well, shit, you haven't even got a chance to really, really instill it because you've been missing so many parts and it's such a revolving door of people. And so I've often said, I felt really bad for Steve having been the first gig or his first gig. And that was before the soap opera that is this year,
And yeah.
I would say to you, I said to my wife, we were watching the game, and while he hasn't gone gray, I said to my wife, man, Steve looks tired.
Yeah.
His face looks tired, So I shot him a text and he said he was good. But yeah, man, I mean, I think you when you know someone like that, put it like this. When he first got the job, and I was thinking about going to join, and and I said no, and they look good. And then they got James Harden. And I was like, shit, like that would have been a great gig. It looks like they're having a blast. And now I'm like, best move I ever made.
Seriously. Well, you think how much luck plays into all this stuff, right? And just like they're killing the Celtics in the first round last year. And everybody's like, oh my God, how is anybody beating this team? And then from that moment on, it just all goes to hell. There's some stuff that was under their control, though, that I feel like, like Harden not being in shape. I have this video. The All-Star game was in L.A. in 2018. And for whatever, I never do this, but for some reason I was taping a play from the All-Star game. And it's Harden in the corner, Westbrook's on him, and he just easily goes by Westbrook and scores. But the striking thing was how incredible shape he was in 4 years ago. And he just looks different. And now it's like, he can still get to where he wants sometimes, but it's almost like watching the old guy who's awesome and pick up basketball, who still knows what he's doing. But I think from a durability standpoint, I would worry about him too. Durant went down because Nash had to play him too many minutes. And then the Kyrie saga. But the Harden not coming in shape when we had, 4 or 5 months between the end of the playoffs last year and heading into this year was such a weird way to start the season. Then Kyrie COVID right after. And I don't know, man. Sometimes it's luck, but it's also kind of self-imposed bullet wounds. And it's like this weird combination of both of them where now I'm looking at it like, are we going to remember this team the way we remember your son's team? Where we look back and we go, how the fuck did that team not make the finals? Yeah. But that's how we look at it now. And are we going to look at the Nets that way?
That's a good question. you know, as far as James Harden goes, and that, you know, LeBron's kind of like this for me. Still brilliant. I mean, I'm the biggest LeBron fan out there, but not the same guy, right? Like, still can do things that other people can't. But if you compared it to what he was, you know, 6 years ago, we can't, like, he's not the same guy. He doesn't get by people the same way. Like, you know, still has great lift, not the same lift. Like, that's just Father Time, right? Like, it's just, you know, and LeBron takes care of himself in a way that no one else does. And so as it pertains to James Harden, he's not the same guy. Like, I don't doubt that skill set and ability is in there somewhere. But, you know, sometimes when you go somewhere and that role changes on you, and it's not all on your back, and so you can just take a breath, whatever that breath looks like, whether it's not, you know, conditioning the same or having whatever it looks like. I don't know, because I'm not in James Harden's like circle to know how he works and stuff. But sometimes if it's not all on you, maybe it just changes the way you approach it fractionally. And the NBA is one of those fractional type of games when you're talking about the best players on the planet, right? Like, it's any little advantage and the separation is not as big as a lot of people think. And so if you lose your edge, then you do kind of become a different player. It's still very good, but maybe just not what you were somewhere else.
Well, I say this on the behalf of the normal people. You were not a normal person in your 20s because you're a professional athlete. You had to stay in shape. But yeah, when for us normal people out there, you hit this point in your late 20s when your metabolism changes a tiny bit, where you realize, oh, maybe I can't stay up till 3:30 in the morning, three times a week, drinking and then having pizza at 2 in the morning and all that stuff. And all of a sudden you're like, wait, did I gain weight? I remember I got a treadmill when I was like, 28, 29. So I was just like, I was getting a little chubby and I started playing video games on the treadmill and I worked it up. And the only reason was because you get older, your body changes. And I wonder with Harden now, he's in his early 30s. He's been in the league since 2008 or 2009. I can't remember what I'm looking, 2009. And sometimes you get older and the guys who've had the unbelievable careers, like the real true top 20, top 25 guys, some of those guys were able to have this second life. Like Kobe's a great example, your guy. Kobe has the second peak from 08 to basically 2012, right at the point when you kind of could go either way as a superstar, right? You could move into that next stage where you're a star, but Kobe has this 2.0 thing. Jordan had the same thing. Even Duncan, who was so steady for so many years, but figured out how to play with like basically 1.5 legs. One of his knees didn't totally work. I wonder with Harden, like sometimes that's it. You know, your body changes and if you don't do enough to fight it off, you kind of are who you are. So in a way, I'm more impressed that he's able to still get a lot of the production that he used to get when I don't feel like he has the same quickness anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thought. And like, just to kind of dig into it a little bit, I think a lot of the guys that you're talking about, maybe this has something to do, you know, with the way the game is played today versus, I'd just be interested to see how the player like James Harden, if or of the like, right? In this game where everyone has the ball in their hands and they're these amazing shot creators and there's all this space, but you're often like very far away from the basket, which requires either deep threes or really good first steps to get where you want to go, right? How do you evolve into a different player? Because Kobe, like, you know, I guarded him for a lot of his career. He just, you know, when I guarded him in Philly, we were out on the perimeter. When I was really young and he was like a relatively young superstar,
yeah,
he was beating you with his quickness. You know, it was, but then he just became surgical, like on the elbow area or with his back to the basket. And so it didn't have to beat you with pure athleticism anymore. You know, MJ did that too.
Yeah.
Like it became a different game for them. Tim D did it a little bit where I'm better than you. I'm more cerebral than you. My skill level is higher. I might not jump the same or have the same twitch, but I've just reinvented myself as this offensive player. But the game at that point kind of lended itself to being able to do that because you had players touching the ball on all different spots of the court. Now everyone touches it basically in the same place, out on the perimeter. And so it's going to be interesting to see as guys start to lose those steps. Like, how do they reinvent themselves as scorers if that's their job?
Dirk's another good example of that. Dirk,
yeah,
just basically second half of his career just masters the foul line. It's like, I'm going here. Nobody's done this quite this way before, but this is now my spot and you're not going to be able to stop me. Kobe.
Paul Pierce did it too.
Yep. And I think you mentioned LeBron, not the same guy athletically, but has also reinvented himself in some really smart ways, right? He has that crazy step back three that if I'm the other team, up until about 2 years ago, you're throwing a party every time he does that shot in the last 3 minutes of the game. It's like, please keep shooting that. And he would shoot it sometimes if he was trying to get in some mano a mano contest with some shooter on the other team. Ultimately, a bad shot. You always want him going to the basket, posting up. Now it's like he's got this crazy step back three that he makes more often than I'm kind of prepared for. I actually don't know how it goes in as often as it does. And then he's also around the rim a lot more than he used to be. I mean, considering going back to the JJ Barea days. But
yeah,
he can punish people now, and he's stronger, and he's figured out like this whatever 3.0, 4.0 version. So I guess with Harden, I mean, we're talking about the same thing. What is the reinvention stage for him? Because he's reinvented himself a couple times, especially like 2017-18 range when he was basically like point guard, three-point shots and free throws. That was it. Now he's kind of like point guard James, but you know, there's moments, really sloppy moments, like the Cavs game I was watching yesterday where, you know, he just knocked over somebody when he had the ball because the guy just, Garland just jumped in, got a charge from him right under the Cavs basket. Just atrophy stuff. And you saw it with Iverson. You were there for the heyday of Iverson. He didn't take care of it. And when it goes, sometimes when you don't take care of it, it doesn't go. I don't know how hard Harden works, but I know that he's not in the right shape.
I don't know him either. It appears to my naked eye that he doesn't look like he's in the best shape either. You know, I think another good point, like he's probably, you know, he morphs into a different type of player, more PG-ish, maybe not as prolific a scorer as he was, but still brilliant with the ball in his hands and so on and so forth. And you know, just to defend him a little bit, like when you're playing the point, I had a knockdown drag out with my 13-year-old the other day in practice. Like he absolutely hated me, told his mom, like I was every name in the book. Right. But he's changing from a two to a point. And it's a really difficult job. And that was the, you know, after cooler heads prevailed and we sat down, that's what I said to him. I said, listen, man, this isn't going to be easy. Like you're making a transition from a player that's got, you know, very limited responsibility for what the team looks like as a whole to one that is really orchestrating everything that takes place. And yep. So as that pertains to James, in the chaos that is the Brooklyn Nets team from night to night, it's got to be really hard for you to look great when you're trying to orchestrate like and make all this music and all these instruments fit in, and you never know what instruments you're going to have from night to night. Like, do you know what I mean? Like sometimes you don't, you know, a lot of your instruments aren't orchestra quality instruments, right? And then, you know, sometimes your orchestra quality instruments are there, sometimes they're not. And so just in his defense, I think kind of their unstableness as a team might lend itself to like him not looking, you know, great at times.
Yeah, I think I'm probably too hard sometimes with this stuff because I do feel like when you're a professional athlete, your number one job is to optimize whatever your body potential is. Like what when you think about it, like you show up on time and you get the most out of whatever God gave you. I know you probably talk about this with your son too, but you know, my son wants to play tackle football next year and he's really serious about it and he really wants to play and he wants to have an impact. And this is the first time we had a real conversation. Like, look, it's not just about the games now. Like if you really want to do this, and he hasn't started doing weightlifting and all that stuff yet, but he's going to. And it's like, look, now it's an everyday thing. Yeah. If you want to be great at something, it's putting in the time day after day after day after day. That's why, you know, it's such a bummer Durant got hurt because I thought his comeback this year was just so incredible. Last year, but then leading into this year where because of the weird team he's on, he had to play this crazy minute load. And I thought he did a better two-way job this year than he did last year. Last year, I thought he would just disappear on defense a lot. This year, took it a lot more seriously, it seemed like, from the games I saw. But they also had to put too many minutes on him, and now he got hurt. And I wasn't shocked, were you?
No. But again, that one of those injuries, I mean, he had a young name, Bruce Brown. Bruce Brown kind of fell back into his knee. I don't know. That's not a wear and tear. Like, I can't hang that on Stevie in the franchise for overplaying him. Although you were overplaying him, and I would bet dollars to donuts that he would get hurt at some point. That you just, the freak one happened before the overuse one happened, right? So, like,
right.
Maybe a blessing in disguise for them. Like, hey, you shut him down for 4 to 6 weeks. Like, if I'm looking for a silver lining, you shut him down for 4 to 6. If we can tread water, you know, that accumulation of minutes and wear and tear isn't nearly the same when he comes back. I don't know. But I think it was bound to happen, Bill. They were just...
It's a good point. It was a freak injury, but also with the use that they were doing. I mean, he had one game where I think they played him the entire second half against Indiana.
Yeah.
It was a lot of stuff like that where... And it's interesting because we've seen this with great players who became coaches. Because they were great players, they look at it as like, oh man, I would have played the whole second half. And, you know, they look at their own great players like, well, I would have done that. And that's how they see the world, right? So Nash is probably going, KD's fine.
No,
36 minutes, who cares?
I know he is because I do the same thing at a much lower level. And I forget often that, like, you know, I blow out a calf in game, I don't know, one of the... of the Western Conference Finals, like, and we have a chance to win a championship, but that's because I'm one of the league leaders in minutes that year, and I never want to come off the court, and Mike's got a really short rotation. And so you quickly forget. No player ever wants to come out. You don't want to come out.
Yeah.
You ask me if you want me to come out. No. What are you talking about? But, you know, sometimes you got to protect people from their own competitive nature for the greater good, which is, you know, trying to stay fresh, trying to stay healthy. I feel the same way about LeBron, Bill. I say it all the time. Like, I love that LeBron is defying all odds in terms of what he's doing at his age, and, you know, but that's not sustainable for him. Even if it is through, you know, 65 games, that body can only take so much. You know, it's too much of a workload for him to just be trying to squeak out a game here and there.
Yeah, and we'll talk about Vogel later, but he was taking heat from Laker fans that I knew for stuff like he's playing DeAndre Jordan. Like, why does he keep playing that guy? And I think he was just looking for any way to try to reduce the load on LeBron. And then finally, they just had to start playing him at the five because their season was about to go in the tank. I have some more KD stuff, but let's take a quick break. We'll come back. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Take a minute to check your social battery. How you doing? Does the thought of social events make you feel excited or exhausted? Are you like me where you're looking at April and you're just thinking, man, there's a lot of sports. There's a lot of podcast content. There's a lot of stuff to watch. I got to make sure I don't lose control of the narrative here. Got to spend time with the family. Got to unwind. Got to spend time with my friends. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up heading into the summer. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time, but therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And when you're feeling worn out from socializing, therapy can give you the help for the tools you need to take care of yourself and recharge, because a full battery is the key to a full life. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Bill Simmons today to get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/Bill Simmons. So the KD thing, it's just such a bummer. I think he had one of those careers, which is still in progress, obviously, he's still in his prime, where we're going to look back at all these different moments and go, oh man, why did that have to happen? Why did this? And oh, I wish that hadn't happened. And it's just like, that's where we're heading now. He's been in the league since the 2007 draft, and you have all these little moments, right? Why did Klay Thompson have to get hot in that game six when they're about to make the finals? Why did KD have to get hurt that one year with OKC? Why did Westbrook have to get hurt that one year? Why did everybody have to get hurt that third Warriors year, right as they were about to cruise to a third title? Why did everybody have to get hurt last year? Why did his foot have to be 6 inches over on the line? Why did he have to pick the one guy in the league who refuses to get the vaccine and now can only play road games and not home games. It's just over and over again. He's won titles. He won an MVP. I think he's one of the 10 best players of all time by any calculation. But you need some luck with this stuff too. Kobe got luck at a really important point when Memphis was like, hey, we're giving away Pau Gasol. And we're not going to talk to any other teams. Any interest? Sure. Here's a really shitty offer for him. Awesome. Here, you have Pau Gasol now. Like, that's really lucky. With Durant, it's just over and over again. The only luck he's had was that the Warriors had all that cap space in 2016 and he was able to join that team. But that became a curse for him too, because then everybody's like, fuck you. Why'd you go to the Warriors? Why didn't you form your own thing? And so in a weird way, the free agency, even the one time he had free agency, didn't move his way because the smartest move for him was the one that everybody got mad about. But I just wonder, when is that guy going to get a break? And then you think like our guy Nash, when is he going to get a break? Nash didn't even make the finals. You had like one of the best teams of that whole decade. Never made the finals. Every year something went wrong. And now this year with Brooklyn, same thing. And it's like, do we need to have an exorcism with those dudes?
I don't know. That's tough. And I, you know, Kevin Durant is the most gifted scorer.
It's the best scoring forward ever. It's not even an argument.
I'm reluctant. I mean, Larry Bird was ridiculous. Like I
caught him at the end. He's right behind me.
No, absolutely. And I caught him at the end of his career. And I've dug back into his videos just because I think it's ridiculous. But Kevin Durant is one of the 2-3 best scorers of all time. It's not even a question.
Well, hold on. The Durant Bird thing, the difference between them as scorers, and I would say Bird and Dirk are probably tied for second. Durant, I still haven't met the person who's like the Durant stopper. Bird had moments where, like, you watch Rodman in the late 80s against Bird and you go, oh man, he's really making him work. You know, Durant has never had that guy in his entire career. Who's the guy who's like, yep, I'm here to stop Kevin Durant? Never happened.
Yeah, well, there you go. When I first saw Kevin Durant, up close to Seattle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had seen him at Texas and I'm not paying great attention to college basketball, but I knew who he was. When we walked out there at the tip and I stood next to that cat, I remember looking over at Mike, like, what in the F do you think I can do with that? He literally doesn't see me down here. Like, I can't. It's just a unique combination of size, skill, athleticism. It's pretty crazy. But
if you're just 30 a night every night, come on, every year, that's fucking nuts.
Yeah. Like, come on, man.
39. It's like, if he doesn't get 30, you're like, what happened? Did he get in foul trouble?
Like, I would never ever put myself in the breath with some of the better NBA players that ever come through the league. But having said that, I was a 13-year NBA player, right?
Yeah.
Like, so I was doing something right. I was okay.
Yeah.
Do you know what it felt like the nights where I did score 30? Do you know how much of an output physically it took to score 30 points? They were some of the best nights of sleep I ever had. Not because I felt great, but because I had just done such an amount of work to do that on a nightly basis. Like, this is just cake for me. It's unbelievable. Like, and when I say that, people are gonna be like, okay, no, I mean, it's unbelievable. Like, you couldn't fathom being able to do that. Like, it's incredible.
To do that 70 out of 82 games or whatever.
I don't know what you would compare that to, man. It is you are the best ever and at what you do. Like, I don't know who that is, but that's what it is. It's, you know, Bill, your random dude. I do this a lot, man. Your random dude at, I don't know, let's say your men's, not like an LA Fitness. Let's say your local men's run that's got some good players at it. You know, that person often thinks that they could hop in an NBA game and, you know, survive. You're wrong. You could not. Like, you're not going to survive. You're not going to get a bucket. Like, you know, so you're skewed already to what you think it is. And you kind of just don't really appreciate what's going on. But that guy that's getting, he's getting 30 when, like, my job as the best defender on my team is to try to stop that. I've watched 2 days of film on everything he does to try to take it away. Our whole team scouting report for the morning and pregame was all predicated on the plays that get him the ball where he wants to get it and stopping that. And I've got all of that flying at you. And every single night you drop 30? Unreal. It's unreal.
Also from different spots. I was looking for this. Kurt Goldsberry did this. He did this zone thing of the most points scored in every zone. And so it's like, I don't know, probably like 25, 26 zones on the court. And Dirk has six of them. And they're all basically around the key. He scored the most points in each of these zones. Now, Durant will probably pass some of these people in the zones. But I think Durant, when he has the ball on the right side and he can go right and shoot that little jumper on the baseline, is one of the five or six most unstoppable shots in the history of the league. The Skyhawks number one. It's always going to be number one. But I haven't seen really anybody figure out how to stop that. Sometimes they jump at his legs when they know he's going to do the move, and it'll oftentimes be a foul. But that's the one time where they try to knock him off balance so he loses his handle. And I think about him a lot compared to Tatum because I have to watch Tatum all the time. And Durant's handle is so much better than Tatum's handle. It's like the biggest difference between them. Because I think a lot of the same pieces are there. Durant's shot is more consistent. I mean, obviously, he's better. He's taller, all these things. But ultimately, his handle and his ability at 7 feet to just go wherever he wants, but then be able to spring up, and every time it's the perfect shot. And the thing with him is, this is why he clicks with Kyrie, because he really works at this. You know, It's like to him, he feels like he's an artist. And all he wants to do is play basketball and work on moves and work on his shots and these things. And that's why he loved Kyrie, because Kyrie is like an artist. He's ambidextrous. He has the perfect kind of finishes, left, right, step backs, come around. And so I think those guys clicked just because the artistry of what they were doing, they could connect with each other. So I loved watching Durant this year on this weird, crazy Nets team. Just like, I don't care who I'm playing with, I'm getting between 30 and 35 points today. And that's it.
Can't stop it. I've said it earlier on this pod, and I will include Kevin Durant in it when I'm talking about feeling bad, because what starts to happen is it becomes a narrative about you, right? Like if you're Kevin Durant or even Stevie, if they can't get that done, about your ability to really lead, you know? And I don't think they've been dealt a fair hand. I think the rug was pulled out from under them with obviously the whole COVID situation and the vaccine versus non-vaccine and the decision being made. And I'm not even going to get into that, but like you're missing a part of what that was supposed to be. So if ultimately it doesn't work or come to fruition, like I don't think it's a fair narrative, but I think you are on the right path. Like ultimately that those are going to be questions that people ask if we're sitting there and saying, well, how come he never got to a finals? Like either, you know what I mean? Like that's right. What's going to happen.
And that's without Curry and Draymond.
Yeah.
I actually heard on a radio or a podcast recently, I heard somebody, this is how crazy the Nets season is, wondering if the Nets were better off not having one of the top four seeds in the East, because if there was a game seven in each round, you'd have Kyrie for the road game. And I'm like, this is where we've reached for our guy Nash, that he has to get a five or below seed so he can have one of his three best players in a game seven. This is where we've landed.
That says it all.
You know, the other thing, it hurts me to say this. I don't like when guys are washed, when they pass that point of no return. You can see it, especially in basketball. It's the most obvious of all the sports. It happens in every sport, right? Dante Hightower for the Patriots. He's too slow now. He was an amazing middle linebacker. He was one of the biggest reasons we came back against the Falcons. Like an incredible Patriot. But now he's too slow to be a middle linebacker, and you could really feel it in the Buffalo game, and it happens. I watch Griffin and Millsap, and it's just like these guys aren't guys you can have in a playoff rotation anymore. And I think they were actually, with the way this team was constructed, with the three stars, Joe Harris is the fourth contract, Patty Mills as the mid-level exception, and then you need to get lucky with 6, 7, 8, and 9. And they just haven't. Dayron Sharp is interesting. It seems like they're kind of nudging toward him and nudging away from Claxton, who's going to be a free agent. Other than that, like they have two-way guys that you can't even use in the playoffs, so they're actually relying on now. But the fact that the Griffin piece, which they had last year, I don't know why he was good last year, not good this year. But the fact that they don't have him, they still need some sort of center big guy when everybody's back, which they had with Jared Allen. But they had to throw in, they had to throw into the Harden trade. I'm voting Jared Allen for the All-Star team. Right. It was a fucking throw-in because Houston's like, hey, can you get us one more pick? They're like, cool. All right, I guess we can trade Jared Allen for a non-lottery pick in the first round. Houston's like, great, let's do that. So it's just that the roster is really flawed. And that's the other thing where they're going to spend over $100 million on luxury tax, Raja, and they still have a flawed roster. How's that possible?
Well, that takes me to the next person that I'm going to have to feel bad for. And maybe I shouldn't, but I like him. Because all of that falls squarely on the shoulders of Sean Marks.
Yep.
That's not a Stevie issue. That's not a KD issue. That's a Sean Marks issue.
Right. Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, they're going to get some reps with Kyrie and Harden without KD. The KD injury, he's had this, a version of this before that he had with the Warriors that, we actually did a podcast with him right after he got injured when he was on the Warriors. And he was like, I thought I was out for the year. They do the MRI. It's like, no, it's actually MCL. It's a couple weeks. We'll see. It could be 4 weeks. It could be 3 weeks. It could be 8 weeks. Who knows? The only silver lining, if you're them, is at least Kyrie and Harden on these road games can play together. I think, I'm wondering if they're going to just say fuck it and just pay the fine and have Kyrie play home games. Because what's weird is the unvaccinated guys on the other team can play in Brooklyn. And that's fine. But if you actually live there, you can't. So we'll see. But speaking of a front office screwing up a team, so you have this Lakers situation. There was a story today in The Athletic that Frank Vogel was on the verge of getting fired after that blowout loss the other night. Then the Lakers came back. They beat the Jazz last night. A really weird game where Stanley Johnson became the best player in the game. And I was watching it, not understanding it. Utah, a lot of Utah awards popped up, which we can talk about later. But Vogel, everybody's been saying this for 2 months. Vogel's going to become the fall guy for this. I'm not positive he cares. He got an extension. He won a title. And it's ridiculous to blame him. But you think, like, is it Vogel's fault they traded all of their depth for Russell Westbrook? Is it Vogel's fault they re-signed Talen Horton-Tucker and let Caruso go? Is it Vogel's fault that they thought DeAndre Jordan and Trevor Ariza could still play basketball when we have 3 years of evidence now that they can't? Was it Vogel's fault that they drifted towards shooting and ignored all the Raja Bell types that actually helped teams win titles? Like, I just don't know how this is the coach's fault, but this is how professional basketball goes.
It's exactly how it goes. And I'm with you in the camp of not so sure Frank Vogel's going to care. Like, at this point, it's another situation that I'm not envious of the coach to have to be in. It's just, it is a mess. And I would ask the question, like, if you were going to fire him after the loss, what, because you won the game, that changed? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, what are we doing here? I don't understand. Like, go ahead and hang it around his neck and let's be done with it and let's move on. No, it's not his fault. Like, he didn't have anything to do with that. I would be interested to know, again, huge LeBron fan, but I was in a front office in Cleveland with LeBron on the team. And I want to be clear. LeBron never, like, comes, hey, I want you sign this guy right now. Like, that's not the way that works, right? But there is some sort of dialogue between, you know, your best player and the franchise and the GM as it pertains to talent that he thinks might work with him. You know, that's just a prudent thing to do. Like, you're going to go in and be like, hey, man, you think you can rock with Bill? Like, did Bill? Yeah, man, Bill's going to be great. Boom.
I can hit 18 footers. I think I would be able to fit in. Go ahead.
Right. I want to know how much of it was a collaborative effort between, you know, the front office and LeBron, because I do know he favors certain dudes. And I know this as a fact. When you are an aging player, and LeBron is that, like, you see players from your prime in a light that they're not in all the time anymore. Right? Like, because it's just, you're looking at it through your prism, right? I'm still that guy. And so X, Y, and Z was my nemesis 7 years ago. He's still the guy, and it doesn't work like that. You know? And so that's interesting to me.
We used to talk about this with Doc Rivers. When he took over the Clippers, they would keep gravitating to these guys that always played well against the Celtics when he was there, the Clippers. So the best one was when they signed Byron Mullins to some contract because he'd had this one awesome game against Doc. And he was like, oh, we got Byron Mullins. It's like that he had the game of his life against your team. But he would do that over and over again. With LeBron, that's a great point with Westbrook. He's judging him from 4 years ago, Westbrook. LeBron's not on League Pass watching all the Wizards games last year. He also clearly drove that signing. Like, there's no two ways about it, because the stories that came out after were, I invited Russ over, we had wine, we talked about what it would look like. I think they really thought, like, we'll make this work. You put three great basketball players on one team, they'll figure it out. And I was borderline apoplectic, and I can't stay in the Lakers. So on one hand, I was delighted that they made that trade, because you knew it was like such a low upside, high downside. But I was more just stunned as in 2021 that somebody could make a mistake like that. That was a mistake that's like out of the 1980s, when they would just go get random dudes and throw them together and be like, oh, I guess that's not going to work. This is like, we had mountains of evidence that Westbrook can't play off the ball and that LeBron has to have the ball all the time. So what are we doing?
No, I hear you. And having said I hear you, I thought it might work. I thought it might work. I knew that. I did. I know Russ has to have the ball. LeBron has to have the ball. Somewhere deep down inside of me, I wanted to think that the two of them at this point, knowing it was probably the last go around, were going to be able to figure that out. And what I thought with two aging stars, right? Like both on the backside of it, what I thought could float them was the one star that wasn't in the same class as them in terms of, you know, age and point in career, which was AD's kind of young vibrance. Like, and
yep,
you know, both of you take a little bit off your plate, let him go to work, and then become, you know, and none of that's come to fruition. So I'm kicking myself in the ass because I should have known. But I was so hard-headed, and I just thought, hey, maybe they'll work it out.
Russell and I went all in on this will not work out. And I've watched way more of the Lakers than I want to admit.
Yeah.
Either it's a beautiful train wreck, or they'll have moments like last night where it kind of clicks a little bit. Westbrook has a dunk over Gobert. Westbrook has the game-clinching three-point play, and Stanley Johnson comes in. He's doing stuff, and now it's like, all right, this is like, now Davis comes back. But defensively, it's just never going to happen because it's too hard for them to sustain even like a C-plus defensive effort. So if shots aren't going in for even a quarter, they completely fall apart. And, you know, LeBron, at this point in his career, like, it's a little like the Brady had this issue in the Patriots where not only is he incredibly famous and not only does he have the ball a lot, but he's also playing in some cases with people who are like 13, 15, 16 years younger than him, mm-hmm. who grew up watching him and maybe idolizing him. And it's hard to play with your idols. Kobe had the same thing. Jordan had the same thing when he was on the Wizards. You're not really a teammate at that point. You're kind of levitating above everybody. Davis, he's fine with because, you know, they same agency and, you know, he's a little older, but for the most part, you're relying on some of these young kids who grew up watching LeBron. And now it's like, hey, here's a huge pressure situation. You've got to make these fourth quarter shots. I don't know. It's just, it's a mess. And I don't know how you fix it. Cause the worst thing about the Westbrook trade for them, and I keep making this point, is it removed all their flexibility. If it doesn't work, you have no plan B. And that's why I hated the trade. I didn't hate the chance that they took as much as the fact that because of his contract, there was no way out. You do this and it doesn't work, you have no outs. And LeBron, he's got under contract this year, he's under contract next year. Same for Westbrook. Westbrook might be a little tradable, more tradable next year because he's an expiring. Still going to be tough. He's like going to be at like $47 million. And when you have no outs at the age LeBron is at, the ship has probably sailed. So they're going to need Davis to come back, and they'll need Davis to be the best big guy in the West other than Jokic is really their only path for this working out.
That's it. I mean, that's the only, and I don't, you know, this is hard for me to say because, but I'm going to say it. Like the style that LeBron plays, was a championship bringer. The bubble was weird for me, Bill. Like the bubble year, yeah, they won the chip, but I mean, so much going on that year. Like, I don't know that if that had been a regular season and you had to play that out, I don't know that they were going to be my favorite to win a chip. Like, I'm glad they did. I was pulling for them. But the style LeBron plays, you know, the league has transitioned to a lot of people getting a lot of touches, a lot of playmakers out in space, and pace. Well, when you play with LeBron, it's all the antithesis of that, right? Like, it's a lot of people kind of standing around. LeBron's got the ball, and we don't really want to run. Like, we don't want to get up and down as much, you know? And so I think it becomes harder and harder, not only because they're like, it's this generational gap, and some of these guys might be your you know, have idolized you, but I think stylistically, not a lot [S2] Yep. [S1] Of people play that style anymore, you know? And so you get all these pieces, whether they're great pieces or not, but you're not even getting the best out of them because of the style that you play. And if you're going to do it, then you've got to be LeBron from 3-4 years ago. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, you got, and AD, not just Bron, because I, like, again, I think what he's doing is amazing, but AD's got to be the dude you're talking about. Like, you know, Russ, you got to cut the shit with all the turnovers, and you have to be the Russ, you know, at least in the limited amount of touches you're going to get. You've got to be that Russ from 3 or 4 years ago. And if you're not going to all be those people because our ball's not moving and we're slow and all of that, and we don't defend, then you don't have, you're a 7 or 8 seed, man. Like, you ain't winning nothing.
There was a really fascinating moment yesterday in the Utah game. Like 4 minutes left, Westbrook wasn't back in. And Russell and I were tight. They finally put him back in with like 3:14 left because they were playing better when he wasn't out there for a variety of reasons. Mostly because they usually play better when he's not out there. And Russell is like, oh, Vogel had to put Russ back in. Like, because it was in play for, he just was going to get benched for the whole fourth quarter, which if you're Vogel and you feel like the heat is on, that's the last thing, right? You're like, fuck it. Russ, you're out. Yeah. I got to go with the 5 guys that have a chance to win. You said something interesting about the stylistic stuff with LeBron, because I've talked about this before. And of course, people get mad because, God forbid, it sounds like a critique. It's not. Some guys are just harder to play with than other guys, you know? And I think about this a lot with the Celtics. Tatum and Jaylen, with the way their offense has kind of devolved, are really hard to play with. They're one-on-one guys. They don't have a point guard. And over again, you have these young guys that play with them that are forced to basically stand in the corner. They're not enabled in any way. And, you know, you said you've been watching a lot of Memphis. The thing that jumps out at me with Memphis is how non-ball dominant Ja is. They really, really, really go out of their way to enable all these other people. And Bane gets possessions and Brooks gets possessions. And they'll run stuff through Kyle Anderson. And they're just, the ball's moving and nobody has it for too long. And Ja will happily go to the corner or it'll seem like he's going to the corner. Then all of a sudden they're sending him a sneaky pick. He's coming around. But it's inclusive. And that's why it's like, well, why has Bane developed like he has? Well, because they wanted him to develop. Whereas I look at a guy like Nesmith, who I really liked on the Celtics, who I thought was coming on last year. And now he took a corner three yesterday that hit the side of the backboard. And he's borderline unplayable. And it's because he's just told to run to the corner. He's not enabled at all. So going back to the LeBron thing, like, I think this is, we've seen a 12-year sample size of this now, where other than Kyrie and other than Davis, I think he has been a little hard to play with. Like, Kevin Love definitely goes to Cleveland and his career's really not the same for about 4 years there. But somebody like Malik Monk, who was hot for 5 games and now all of a sudden he's not playing crunch time again. But how do you get in a groove when you don't have the ball a lot? And also, how do you go to other people when you have LeBron James on the court? It's like this chicken and egg thing. So we're going to tell LeBron to stand in the corner? That doesn't make sense either.
Absolutely. No, we.
So it's hard to develop people. And I think Kuzma is a good example of this. Kuzma has been the best guy in the Wizards now for a month. And was somebody that you would watch in Laker games, you'd be like, is this guy even an NBA rotation guy? I don't know.
Yeah, you need opportunity to develop, right? You need opportunity. And I'm not judging. It's a very difficult thing. I've said this about me before. Like, you know, when I when I was in Utah before I went to Phoenix, our offense was kind of wide open. Now, we ran Jerry's style, but within that style, you know, I posted up a little bit. I had the ball in my hand on the wings. I came off a pick and roll, and I was learning how to play pick and roll. I wasn't great at it, but I was learning, right? No one had ever given me the ball before in the NBA, so I didn't know shit. Yeah. I was running around just defending and running wild. But I was starting to understand how to score. Like, oh, you know, I get in this situation, I get a switch, just be patient. I'm going to be good. I got something on me that I can cook. Like, I was starting to learn. And then I went to Phoenix. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It was, those were the best years of my life, the best teams I ever played on. But my game stayed right there.
Stagnated.
It just stopped. I became a run-to-the-corner shooter. That's what I was going to be. It was probably the best thing, because I don't know that I was good enough to play the role of anything better than that on an NBA level. But the point is, I have experience with that, right? Like, you're now your job, like, get it to Steve. He's going to run pick and roll, and you guys are going to shoot when that pick and roll doesn't work. And so I was like, you know, I was getting paid well, and we wanted to win. And so then you dig into that role and be the best you can. But as you're trying to develop talent, like, I was older, but as you're trying to develop young talent that can kind of help a LeBron or someone like that, man, there's got to be opportunity, right? You got to get off the ball a little bit to give them the breath to kind of to grow. Not that LeBron doesn't, but the style that he plays, it's not enough for everyone out there to really kind of dig into to who they are as a player.
Well, and there's also certain guys that it makes sense for them to be on a team like that. Like, the Celtics have Grant Williams, who I had given up on last year, but I think has emerged as a rotation asset this year. And the reason is he just became really good at corner threes, because he's too small to post up. He's a good rebounder. But ultimately, you're not going to run plays for him. So if he can't learn to shoot from the corner, there's no reason to have him.
Right.
But he learned how to shoot. Now he's one of the best corner three guys. So it's like, he makes sense. But when I look at some of the perimeter guys in the league, or even some of the point guards, like after watching Dennis Schroeder for half of the Celtics season, I can't believe he played with LeBron. It's such a bad combo. Like, right. Schroeder's like, the defenses just sag off him completely. And I can understand why the Lakers were anxious to get rid of him. But I look at a guy like Kuzma as a really good example of, sometimes it's not awesome to play with an incredible player. Because Kuzma has blossomed.
Yeah.
In a way that if I was a Laker fan, I would be losing my mind. That, look, even just Kuzma for Westbrook is a terrible trade. Kuzma at $16 million for Westbrook for $44 million. That alone is a horrible trade. Not to mention you gave two other guys in it.
Hey, well, listen, my people, it's hard to hear, but that 2001 Sixers team, I got there late, and I was around for that run, and then the next year, and that was that was Allen Iverson offensive team, and then you were gritty and grimy defensively. I'm not going to say any names, but there were people on that team that, you know, you're like, shit, I want the ball. Like, I'm an NBA player. Like, I want to taste it. I can do some things, and it just, you know, the opportunity wasn't there. So, you know, that kind of exists, and it puts you in kind of a box, but that box can make you more valuable. Like you said about Grant Williams, like you said about me, it made me more valuable. People wanted me because they knew that I knew what I was coming in there to do. I was coming in there to defend, and I was coming in there to shoot the ball. And there were no mistakes. I wasn't going to be stepping on anybody's toes.
And that's what made that 0-1 Sixers team so special for how it blended with Iverson, because it's really hard to find those guys that blend. Iverson, top three or four most difficult guy, I think, to play with, because he had to have the ball all the time. And that was just the way it went. And he was going to go 13 for 30 and 12 for 29. And that's just the way it was going to go. Plus slower pace. But it had to be people who were ready to shoot if he passed to you, or people that rebounded and played defense. And so that 0-1 team had a lot of those guys. And then as they tried to replicate that over the next 5 years, guess what? It's hard to find those guys. It's hard to find guys who are happy to do that. You know? And you had Aaron McKee and Snow and Mutombo and all these dudes, but there weren't a lot of them.
No, there weren't. And you started getting to the space that we're talking about with LeBron, where you got younger talent that has to grow, and there's just not enough room for them to grow with the way you play.
Like Horton Tucker, who I don't know if he's an NBA starter or not. From what I've seen, he's probably not. But I know this Lakers team makes no sense for him. He seems like somebody, he reminds me of, it's weird because they're different, but Caris LeVert, same kind of way, where Karis LeVert's kind of, he's over here and he's going to do his thing. And TJ Warren's a little bit like this too. Like these guys that are kind of these one man scoring people. They're probably not that much fun to play with, but on the right team, you need guys like that. I don't know how those guys have ever made sense with LeBron.
Yeah.
Just doesn't.
So those guys for me, it's probably not fair to them, but I always see anytime you say a name like that and you describe a game like that, do you know what they are for me? It's probably not fair. It's generalization. It's
losing players.
They're six men on good teams.
Yeah. Right.
You just plug them in. You let LeBron come off the floor. You let him go crazy. If he's cooking, great. If he's not, we're going to go right back, you know? And they're degrees of six men, but like, you know, those guys, and I play with a lot of them, just they're going to get buckets. What I do is get buckets. I had one tell me once, sometimes when you ask somebody to play defense, it just takes away from their offense. That kind of guy, you're a six man, bud. Come in, get buckets.
Right. And that, by the way, that's what Cleveland needs right now.
Yeah.
Because I think Cleveland, I watched them again. They won another one yesterday. The chemistry is unbelievable. They have three just banger young players. The Garland and Allen, and then Mobley, who's my favorite player to come in the league in a while. But the one thing they need is the guy you just mentioned, who, because they lost Colin Sexton, they lost Rubio. Mm-hmm. Rubio was really, even though he wasn't shooting that well, he was important for them because he was inclusive. But then now they need the one guy who can carry them for little 7-minute stretches in each half, right? When Garland's out or whatever. There's the guy that I tweeted yesterday. Eric Gordon would be the absolute perfect guy for them to get. And they have Rubio's expiring. They have picks. He can come off the bench. The good thing about him is he actually isn't just the it's all about me guy. He can also, like, we've seen him be able to play with other people too in another scenario. So I tweeted the standings yesterday. I was stunned by how close the Cavs were to the top. Like, we're in situations where the Cavs and Memphis are legitimate top four teams, which I don't even know what the odds would have, I mean, in each conference, like they like potential top four seeds.
If you were to ask me who could win a championship right now, like both of those names, like crazy. But if you look statistically at what they're doing, both of those names cannot be left out of that conversation right now. As far as statistics, you can't leave them out.
Well, you think like, and I was trying to figure this out because we're past the midway point, but All-Star Game's coming, so it's a good reset. I would still put my money on Milwaukee in the East just because of the pedigree. And they, you know, now Holiday's out. They'll probably get Lopez back in time. I think Miami, I've been watching them a lot lately. Miami's the team Raja would, out of the 30-team Raja draft for what team would I want to play 12 minutes for, Miami's your team, right?
Yeah, Miami's fun. They get it.
Lowry and Butler are just screaming incoherently at each other and chest bumping, and it's like game 42.
Yeah, they get it.
But they have the shooting. Bam's coming back, and I think that's at some point they're going to be the sexy upside pick.
Yeah.
in the East, especially if we don't know when Durant's come back. But Cleveland is so fucking weird to play, where they're just like, we're just going to play three big guys. And Mobley is so special defensively, we're going to be allowed to do this. And we are going to zag. The league's zigging. We're zagging. We're going to do this. It's really weird to play. And somehow, we are awesome defensively when we get stops. And we have a special player in Garland who in the last 3 minutes of a game will get us good shots. And that's going to be enough. And so far, it's been enough.
Yeah, I don't see everything coming. But some of this you could see, like Atlanta, you know, people hated when I said it. I kind of saw this one coming. Like some things you see coming. I had no idea that this was coming.
You not like in Atlanta? Too many guys?
Too many guys. Too many guys kind of at similar points in their career. I thought a year ahead of schedule last year. So, you know, that kind of puts young people, especially into the weird summer space where the hunger isn't always there. Like there were a lot of things that I thought would kind of have them take a step back, but I couldn't have called Cleveland. Even after my buddy Kobe Altman told me, he was like, yeah, we really like what we have going on and all that. I was like, yeah, okay, but good talking to you.
I talked to Zach Lowe before the season, and we were just kind of batting around teams. And I was afraid to tell anyone that I really like Cleveland's team because they just had a bunch of guys I liked. And I was all in on Mobley, like all in.
Yep.
And I was like, I kind of like Cleveland. And Zach's like, I do too. And we just like, we had one of those moments. And we took them for the over when we did the over-unders. I thought they had a chance to be like a play-in team and maybe go like 43 and 39 would be like the high upside. What's been shocking to me is that they can get stops and create good shots over and over again in crunch time. And I did not see the Garland thing coming. He was a little bit polarizing in the draft. Russillo loved him. Some of our guys loved him. But, you know, undersized shooting guard as a point guard, you just never know with that. We've seen it go right. Either way. I think what's been cool about him is how innovative he is offensively and how fucking competitive he is. And that, it goes back to, we've talked about this before, like just competitive people. I'm just always gravitating toward them when I'm drafting, especially at the high level. Like, do you give a shit? Garland gives a shit. He's tough. So anyway, I like that team. You've been watching some Memphis, and we can end on this. And Memphis has been the darling, especially it's been a big podcast topic the last couple of weeks. They have a trade to make. I'll be interested to see if they make it because their chemistry is so good that you could argue don't make the trade, but they have 3 first round picks. They have Adams who's an expiring next year, Kyle Anderson. Would you mess with this team? If you're the GM, would you try to upgrade anything or are you just riding with what you have right now?
I think I'm riding, Bill. Because I think this team more than a lot of other teams is built on that chemistry, that vibe that they seem to have. You talked about John Morant's willingness earlier in the pod to kind of be over in the corner and off the ball and now trusting that I'm going to be brought back to the ball and it's not that I'm just going to, you know, wither away over in that corner. Like, there's a lot of trust that goes into people, you know, being willing to give up a little bit of themselves or give up the ball a little bit for the greater good. And that comes off the screen when I watch them play. Like, you know, it comes across like a fun team to be on, a fun team to work with. And so I don't, you know, if I could upgrade and I didn't have to give up something like integral to what we were doing out there, maybe I would. So if you're talking about a draft pick maybe, and I don't have to give up one of the main pieces, like if there was something out there, I wouldn't say no, but I'm not giving up any of the pieces that are really out there playing meaningful minutes. I can't do that.
I would have said Adams as the piece, but there was a moment I was watching Bulls Grizzlies yesterday. Ja got wrapped up by some Bulls guy who held on to, I think it was Tony Bradley, who held on to him too long. Ja got mad and shoved him.
Yeah.
Adams comes right in, grabs the guy behind him, and pulls him away and was basically like, you will not touch Ja Morant. That's it. Don't do that again.
He might have the least amount of value like on the court. I haven't looked into the statistics, but I'd argue that a dude like that, like he's probably behind closed doors, one of the backbones of what they do there. Do you know what I mean?
Beloved teammate and the first guy in anytime anything's going on. So I actually wouldn't trade him.
Yeah, but you know, I love the reason, not that you asked me, the reason I first of all, I've been on the John Morant signature shoe deal. Like, I like Memphis. This isn't 2 weeks from me. I've been telling, like, come on, man. Like, man, we got to pick up on Memphis. But they just get up and down. Like, they're number one in the league in fast breaks. They turn you over. They're out. They're aggressive defensively. They're in the passing lanes. And I just love how it's opportunity for dudes that like Bane and like Dylan Brooks, who I didn't see coming a few years ago, but just is like
your spiritual son, Dylan Brooks.
Yeah, you talk about competitive. Like, I'm not taking any shit from anyone. And yes, I could do. Like, they have a bunch of cats like that, and I really enjoy watching them hoop.
Yeah, you could have definitely been on that team.
Yeah, I'd like to play on that team. Now, Dylan Brooks is way better than I thought he was going to be. But the way they get down, the way they strap up, the way that ball moves, I would. That's one of. It's one of a handful of teams that I would have liked to play it on.
Really fun. See, the league's just fucking deep. Like, we're going to do all-star picks with House in a second. The fact that the East is now deep from a talent standpoint, and the West is, I mean, you think of all the guys that are injured this year. We have we don't have Davis and we don't have Dame. And, you know, we don't have Durant. We have mm-hmm. Kyrie half the time. We lost Jamal Murray. We lost Michael Porter. Like yep. we've lost like seven or eight guys on top of all of these awesome young guys that we have. But the biggest thing is this 2021 draft, I think, has a chance to be remembered as impactful. Because Mobley and Cade and Giddy and they're just Kuminga as a fucking X factor. Kerr casually dropping Giannis in a Kuminga sentence last week. I was like, whoa, Kerr likes him. All right, Raja, we'll let you go back to what's the plan today? You have a prodigy QB son.
Yeah, we're going to a workout right now at 2:30, man. He's got his quarterback trainer. And then we got varsity basketball at 3:45, Bill. And then right after that, I got my seventh grade team at 6. So I'm pretty packed this afternoon.
So you're coaching the seventh graders?
Yeah, I coach a high school team and I coach seventh graders, yes.
So the seventh graders, a little touchy, right?
Yeah,
it's a touchy age. Seventh grade's touchy. There's a lot going on. You got hormones going on, all kinds of things.
They've become little buttheads, like right around there. Like some of them are little buttheads already. Some of them are, yeah. So it's hard to keep the reins. You got to keep the reins real tight with that group.
My least favorite grade. anyway, all right, Raja, we can listen to you on Real Ones.
That's it,
the Ringer NBA show. Good to see you as always.
Thanks for having me, brother. Anytime.
All right, Joe House is here. He is doing a little House of Carbs experiment on our revamped food feed, which is now called Ringer Food. He's also on the Fairway Rolling podcast and with Warren Sharp on Fridays on the Ringer Gambling Show. We're going to talk NBA first just because Raja was on. We were talking NBA. I have to put in all-star picks by Saturday, House. It's surprisingly non-controversial for the most part. I'm going to throw some questions.
Okay.
So,
okay.
You know, you look at, the starters, which the fans have input. Who the hell knows how it's going to play out? But Embiid, Durant, Giannis in the East. And then the guards I've seen go different ways. I'm going to vote for Trey and DeRozan. Some other people would push for LaVine or Harden there, but Trey's offensive season. DeRozan's a forward. I'm, cheating a little bit, but I just feel like those have been the best five guys. Embiid, Durant, Giannis, Trey, DeRozan. Durant's not playing because he's hurt. But does that five sound right for you, or would you throw in Harden or LaVine?
I don't have any quibble. Who's going to replace Durant in the game? We don't care about that for voting purposes?
We don't. But that does come into play because my next seven, LaVine, Van Vliet, Butler, Harden, Garland, Jared Allen, Tatum. I have to have two Cavs. I love that team. I have to reward them. So LaMelo was on the outs for me. And it basically came down to Van Vliet, Harden, Garland, and LaMelo for three spots. Tatum makes it just because the forward pool is so weak this year. LaMelo I have as 13th, but he gets in because KD's not playing. And this is like my most important thing with the All-Star game this year is LaMelo has to be in the game. That should be our number one priority, right?
It's a really, really important addition to the mix because of the kind of player that he's revealed himself to be. He has so much swag, so much flair. He really deserves it. Charlotte is playing very well, and they've continued to be above water, even with, Hayward, the typical Hayward in the lineup, not in the lineup. I have to for the starting five thing, just give a real quick shout out to LaVine.
Yeah.
He's been, I fear him. DeRozan, I think he's earned it. I love that, he's getting all this shine and we're talking about MVP and he'll get some votes and that's cool. Good for DeMar to get to this level, to, constantly working his ass off to reinvent his game to get better. I don't fear DeMar DeRozan. I fear Zach LaVine.
Interesting. Yeah, they're 1A, 1B. I just DeRozan because of what he brought to that team and some of the end of the game shots and just how ridiculously, meticulously efficient he's been in the fourth quarters. But yeah, if you're going to get technical and go, wait, you can't have DeRozan because you already have three forward centers on the team. So you got to have two guards. I'm fine with putting LaVine there. The LaMelo thing, we always talk about how the All-Star game ebbs and flows depending on how many fun point guard type people there are, right? And we've had years where Chris, once Steve Nash retired, where it was like, oh my God, and Jason Kidd was another one that we lost. And then it was like, oh my God, there's so much pressure on Chris Paul now. He's the only one who knows how to run an all-star game. LaMelo is going to be just really important for the next 12, 15 years. By the way, not that the all-star game really matters, but it can be an awesome, fun, upside viewing experience if the point guards are there.
And on top of that, we do continue to use it as a marker for a player's, you know, achievement. As we look back at the top 75 rankings, you know, of this year with the anniversary, number of times on an all-star team do weigh in a little bit.
Yeah, and also who's out there with 7 minutes left, a lot of times is a nice reflection on who the best 8 to 12 guys are in the league. Because for the most part, you know, Dame was out there for a couple years and now he's out. But you think, like, you go to the West is tougher because Jokic and LeBron, and I think Curry, just from, even though he tailed off a little bit, I still think those three are going to start. But then, do you just go with three guards? Because the best five guys in the West this year have been Jokic, LeBron, Curry, Morant, and CP3. And that's who I'm going to vote for. It's bending the rules a little bit because you're basically doing the three-guard lineup. You could say Curry can play off the ball, whatever. But that's my next question for you. Are you okay with me bending the lineup?
Of course. Yes. Okay. We're in positionless NBA. That's the era that we're in.
Okay, because if you weren't okay with it, now we have to have the Karl Anthony Towns conversation. I had him as my bubble starter guy because Luka, you know, Luka missed too many games and he needs to be penalized for coming in too heavy. Towns, somebody that you and I have been incredibly frustrated with over the years. I really like what I've seen this year from him.
Critical of.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, we have long wondered whether his inconsistency is attributable to franchise instability, coaching instability, coaching, you know, underwhelming coaches.
Weird teammates.
And, you know, weird mix, sure, all of it.
Yeah, so are you buying Towns stock? Like, where are you? Because I like them. Like,
sure, I'm buying Towns stock. Me too. I'm rooting for them to make the playoffs. I think the West is more interesting if Minnesota is in the playoff mix.
Well, it would be fun to have Edwards in the playoffs. My backups would be Towns. It's weird. The West is like very easy to figure out. The backups would be Towns, Luka, Mitchell, Draymond, Booker, Gobert. And then I have Murray as the 12th guy. I think he's been one of the 12 best guys I saw in the West. I've seen a couple. There's other lists I've seen out there where, like, maybe Edwards gets in there. There's some Andrew Wiggins buzz. Paul George can't be penalized because he missed too many games. He's got to be on there. I get it, but I think Murray's been really good. I mean, to the point that it's inconceivable now that they would flip him in a Ben Simmons trade. I think he is a better asset, and he might actually be more of a winning player than Simmons is. So that's my 12, and I don't really think there's an argument. What do you think?
I think you're right. I would love to figure out a way to get Edwards in, but I don't think it should come at the expense of Murray.
Well, somebody will get injured.
Too.
Yeah, the actual All-Star game isn't for 4 or 5 weeks, so I'm sure out of those 12 guys, somebody gets injured. So just very small arguments. Jared Allen or Mobley? I went with Allen because I think he's been more consistent. I just absolutely love Mobley, but he's also, you can make a case, Allen's the second best center in the East, unless you want to call Giannis a center, then he's third. But either way, it feels right for me to pick him over Mobley. But, you know, I freaking love Mobley. It was hard to leave him off. And I'm hoping if there's one more injury, I think he's the next bubble guy after LaMelo.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah. So Allen or Mobley, you'd go Allen, seems like.
You have Mobley ahead of Bridges?
Yeah, I have for bubble guys Mobley, Jalen, Bridges, Holiday, Sabonis. And then it dips off to that Bradley Beal, Middleton, Hero group. But yeah, I just think I just value the winning stuff, right? And the Cavs have the Cavs aren't that far away now from having the best record in the East, and it's because of Mobley and Garland and Allen over anything else. So, and the stuff, the fact that Mobley defensively can guard anybody allows them to play these weird big lineups that nobody knows what to do with. They're really hard to play. It's just because of what he can do. So yeah, I value the Mobley thing, but I'm probably overthinking that because I value the winning stuff too much.
He's going to make all rookie first team. He, you know, will remain in the conversation for rookie of the year if he can remain healthy. And I think that's
this will be the last year he's not in the All-Star game. So Evan Mobley, if you're listening, this is your last year.
I agree.
Murray or Edwards, you agree with me on Murray over Edwards?
As long as you can assure me that Edwards is going to get in because of an injury, yes, okay. That's fine.
And you're okay with Luka not being a starter?
I am extremely okay with Luka not being a starter. There has to be a price for the fork. The fork has to cost you something.
Who do you have as your MVP so far in the I can't believe you came in this heavy rankings for this season? Do you, Luka over Harden, right?
Oh, it got to be Luka over Harden, yeah. Because I don't know whether this is a function of media hype or what, but you know, every year, the last couple, 2 years, we've entered the season with Luka at the top of the odds as an MVP candidate, and both times he's shown up fat.
Right. I was thinking about it. When we were in college, we used to go to the all-you-can-eat at Papa Gino's on Tuesday nights, and we would go to Fat Dickie's, and you could see how much barbecue you could eat in 2 hours. And we would go to the Ground Round because they had the chicken wings thing, and we would drink beer and all this stuff. Luka isn't really much older than we were in college when we were doing all that stuff. Maybe he just, you know, maybe we just have to think of him as like a college kid, basically. Somebody who's going to make some mistakes, do some dumb things. And when he's 25, all of a sudden, that's when he's going to find yoga and gluten-free and all these things. But right now, he's like we were.
Well, we only went to those places after we played basketball for 3 hours.
That is true. I mean,
like we created the calorie deficit and then we refilled. We refueled and refilled.
Do you think people still do that? We actually did. I feel like we were ahead of our time a little bit in the late 80s, early 90s. We would use the exercise to then justify the overeating. Not that you needed a lot of justification for the overeating, but we would feel like we had earned it in some way. I don't feel like Luka's really came into the season feeling like he had earned the calories, would be my guess.
I'm happy to agree with you.
Okay, so this is the least controversial All-Star kind of process we've had in a while. I wish there were more fun arguments, but there's just not. Let's talk football. Kyler Murray, I knew somebody was burning me yesterday. I didn't know if it was going to be the Rams or the Cards. I fell into the when in doubt, take the point strategy, which is usually the right strategy. Because there was a scenario last night where Matt Stafford just throws four picks. What was stunning to me was how bad Kyler was. It felt like he was on his way to that Jake Delhomme January 2009 game. I disagreed with every choice he made. He wasn't accurate. He was frenetic. He was whipping screen passes 110 miles an hour. That 2 yard pick six he threw, even before that happened, it was like, what's going on with this guy? It was like watching Ben Simmons against the Hawks. Was the feeling I was getting. Came out after halftime and it seemed like he had calmed down, but man, he was so bad in that game. And I've also been on the flip side where you go against Kyler Murray and he's incredible. And I do wonder, like, if he was good in that game, is the result different or were the Rams just better? We'll never know because he was so bad, but it makes me really worried about what is this guy going forward, because he's just been too all over the map. He's been in the league now for a few years. And is this guy somebody who could win multiple games in a row in the playoffs? I don't know. What do you think?
I'm not prepared to talk about him on an island. I'm not prepared to just say, here's my evaluation of Kyler. To me, he's inextricably linked to Kingsbury. It's Kyler and Cliff. What's the game plan? What's the scheme to take the most pressure off of Kyler? This is the thing that the rule that we broke. We had a playoff rookie going up against a guy that has played in the playoffs before. And, you know, the playoff rookies, Jalen Hurts, Kyler Murray, who's the other one I'm not thinking of right now? Mac Jones.
Well, we had Burrow and Burrow and versus against Carr.
The spread. Yeah, but that one doesn't matter. That one doesn't count. When you in with the you know, the trend that we've had, and it's been around for a long time, is a playoff rookie, playoff virgin going up against a more experienced guy, even if they've only played in a handful of games, it matters. It looked like he was completely flummoxed by the speed of the game. It felt like watching a college quarterback, you know, a rookie beginning his NFL career early on, you know, the week one, week two games, not acclimated to the speed of the game. He wasn't up to playoff speed, and Kingsbury didn't do anything to help him. And, you know, the game was over in the first 5 minutes, like many of the games that we watched this weekend.
It really did feel that way. I don't know the answer with him because he's so short that the teams that seem to keep him in the pocket, it just seems to escalate bad decisions. But then you've seen other games where it's like nobody can keep him in the pocket and he's just running around and doing whatever he wants. But he is one of those guys that you kind of know pretty quickly what you're getting in the game, right? If you bet on him or against him, I feel like I know within 20 minutes what I'm getting. Yesterday, I was getting skittish, really weird energy, Kyler, which you think like the QB's the leader of the team. When you see your leader look that kind of rattled, that's not going to go well. But maybe for the manifesto, maybe the rule is playoff virgin QBs on the road. Maybe that's a rule. I think I'm going to have to make it a rule.
It's been there forever. It's been out there. It's not a new thing. The other thing we have to remember, if we're going to talk about Kyler, is missing DeAndre. The Cardinals have stunk since DeAndre's gotten hurt. They haven't, you know, the only credible win they had was going on the road to Dallas, beating Dallas in a place where Kyler hasn't lost. You know, has he ever lost at Jerry World? I don't know.
Yeah, it's the one place that he kind of owns.
Yeah, but that was their only win.
So you're talking to Sharp. I'm going to be doing $1 million picks on Thursday, and you're going to be doing picks with Sharp on Friday. It's tough because I really like the Niners. I want to know what I'm getting from Bosa and Warner. Not going to like them as much if I'm getting none of one guy, half of another guy. But that line's too high, the 5.5. And I think they could win the game. They check a lot of my boxes. I don't think it matters if they're on the home or on the road. They have playmakers. I like their defense. I think they're built to win close games. It's a bad matchup for the Packers, but if I'm not getting those two guys, that makes me worried. The Rams-Bucks, Sal and I did guess the Lions, and I think I guessed 4.5, and he guessed 4 on Sunday night, and the line is 3. And I think it's partly 3 because the Rams looked so good yesterday.
I agree. You're right.
But that's also a manifesto rule of beware of the team that looked a little too good the previous round. I don't believe in the Rams. Do you? The only interesting thing about them in the Cards game was the Cam Akers piece. Wasn't expecting that.
That was an unexpected wrinkle. It adds a complexity to their offense. But the thing that was more impressive was the defense. And if they are able to mount pressure that replicates, it doesn't have to be 100% a version of what they did to the Cardinals. But if it's 75% of what they did to the Cardinals, if they make Tom Brady uncomfortable, that changes the game. That makes it, you know, a field goal kind of game. Tampa's been incredible at home all season long. And they just score points. I'm rooting for a shootout just because I think that would be tremendous fun. But you know, that Rams defense was something else last night.
What was your worst bet of round one?
I just a small bet on the Cardinals last night. I did really well, and Twitter was very complimentary. I had the under in the Cincinnati Vegas game that came through.
Twitter was complimentary. Wow,
I know, it's hard to believe. My favorite bet of the weekend was the Niners money line, and I liked Tampa laying the 8.5. I had no problem at all with that, and you know, people appreciated it.
Yeah, we hit a couple of them, $1 million picks. The Tampa KC bet was our big bet, the tees. And
great one.
The KC game got to where I wanted it to go, where just give them a lead. Make Roethlisberger have to come from behind down 10 or more, and we're golden. And that's what happened. Then they got so big of a lead, the garbage time touchdowns, which is really where Ben has been thriving the last couple of years, down like 20, 25, starting to come back. I was starting to get a little worried about we had an alternate line 20 and a half with the Chiefs. And I was like, oh my God, I have to sweat this out. They were up like 30.
They got close. Yeah. They were going right down the field. My favorite tease was Tampa down to 2.5 and the Niners up to 9 from 3 to 9, because the Niners, you know, Dallas was not going to win by 2 scores under any iteration, I didn't feel like. And so that one hit, and that was a good one.
There's some good teaser possibilities this week, especially being able to take the Bills to 8.5. That line's 2.5 right now. We're going to talk about that on Thursday, but I feel like that's a who gets it last game. And especially totally now that agree. We know that the Bills are just going to put Josh in shotgun and unleash him and do that thing, I think that game's going to have a crazy pace to it. The over-under right now is 54.5, which, I don't know, still seems low to me. You could talk me into like 59. It's like the Bills are going to play at that pace. This feels like remember that Pats-Chiefs game a couple years ago where it was like, what was it, 37-31 as the final or whatever it was? It feels like one of those type of games. What do you think?
Yeah, the funny thing is, there's a stat out there that playoff games that close with a total of 55 points, the under is 8-1, but the only one is Bills and Chiefs. The one is the Bills and the Chiefs. So I'm going to play the over. I mean, I'm going to play what I want to root for, and that's, you know, scoring all over the football field.
You're doing a food thing on House of Carbs with the NFL playoffs, where we're trying to pick out of the 14 playoff teams which city had the best dish in each conference, and then they're going to go out in the Super Bowl. Our friend Dave Jacoby's involved, Mally Rubin, Craig Horlbeck. The way you laid out the parameters, you almost made it impossible for the Philly cheesesteak not to win, because the parameters are basically, if I go to this town, what is the most important food item that I feel like I have to eat? Then quality of the food item, all these things. Philly, out of all the cities, it feels like you have to get a cheesesteak when you're there. And I don't know why it is. I don't know whether it's because Philly's in the name, whether if it was like, if clam chowder was called Boston clam chowder, would that be like better PR marketing for the clam chowder? I don't know. But the Philly cheesesteak seems like a dominant one seed. Who could potentially unseat it? Who are you looking at?
Kansas City, for sure. I mean, Kansas City Barbecue is a nationwide, it's a brand. You can buy Kansas City Barbecue sauce. And the Buffalo Wing, hello, like, it's in the name. Both of those cities have legit claims. Like, if you go to Buffalo and don't have Buffalo Wings, what are you doing? I think both of those have formidable chances to stand up here. And I'm not going to sleep on Green Bay with the brats and the cheese curds. I mean, let them stand. Now, let me ask you a question. I did get some criticism for choosing chowder for New England. There was a strong argument for the lobster roll. Where do you stand on this as a native New Englander?
I would have gone lobster.
Is it the
roll.
Chowder?
No,
so
I think it's the lobster.
I wish
roll.
We had gone. I wish I'd asked you in advance. You know, we did sort of an internet sampling to come up with what was the iconic item. And the lobster roll belongs more to like Maine, you know, it doesn't really belong to the Boston area as much. So that's the reason that we gave the lean, because the stadium's in Foxborough, more proximate to Boston than to Maine. So that's the way. My only regret, and let me get your take on this. The toughest one for me was San Francisco against Dallas. And the reason it was hard is because Dallas has a bunch of outstanding food items, including barbecue and brisket that really belong to Texas writ large. You don't say, yeah, I'm going to go to Dallas and have the brisket. But, you know, and San Francisco has a couple different things. It has Dungeness crab. It has, you know, the seafood stew, Chipino. And then it has this sourdough that you fill up with like a Pacific chowder. And that's what we ended up going with as the iconic item from San Francisco. But it was a really close call, San Francisco versus Dallas. And I regret going with San Francisco because it means that I don't get to eat brisket this week. Where do you come down on it?
Horrible. I don't like
horrible.
I don't like the San Francisco food scene at all. I think the Chinese food's overrated. I don't think they have signature things, and I'm just not a huge fan. You go to Dallas, it's like, guess what? Sorry. Texas counts as part of Dallas. You go to Dallas, like, we went there for the Super Bowl. You were with me. What the fuck did we say when we were there? It was like, hey, where are we getting barbecue? We went to like three barbecue places. What are you doing?
We did.
If we were in San Francisco, we weren't like, oh my God, oh, we got to eat this. We went to a bunch of them. With the lobster roll thing, I mean, in your defense, we've only been close friends since 1988. We talk all the time. It would have been too hard to just send me a short text.
I didn't want to corrupt it.
The problem with the clam chowder as the identifiable Boston food or Massachusetts food, whatever, is that the quality is too up and down. It's all over the map. If you're telling me I could get the greatest, but so many people come to Boston and they go to the wrong restaurant and they get the clam chowder and either it's really mediocre or they actually get food poisoning from the clams. And then they're like, oh, I had the clam chowder. Wasn't that good? Whereas if you have the right lobster roll, really from a bunch of, and it could be anywhere in Cape Cod, it could be anywhere in Maine, a couple of Boston things. It's always going to win. The right lobster roll is fantastic.
Well, here's the thing. It just like in real life, there was no way that New England was going to beat Buffalo. So it didn't really matter, but
it's fair. The Buffalo wings thing. I'm going to zag on the Buffalo wings thing. Yeah. Great. They're called Buffalo wings. I could go to any city and I could get Buffalo wings that will be very close to the Buffalo wings I would get in Buffalo. It's not going to be like a dramatic leap where it's like, oh my God, I've never had Buffalo wings in my life.
You're committing a food crime. This is a food crime. You're committing a food crime.
Why are they better? What is better about them in Buffalo versus another city?
They know exactly how long to fry the chicken wing in the fryer. And their recipe for the sauce is unimpeachable, unimpeccable. It's
no other city
every time.
Can match it.
It's hard to replicate. I'm just telling you, it's hard to replicate.
Philly cheesesteak. Anywhere in Philly I go, I can get a cheesesteak and it's going to be like, wow, this is amazing. Where else am I going to get cheesesteaks? I don't even know. LA is like one of the great food cities of all time. I don't even know where I'd get a cheesesteak here.
Many cities offer cheesesteaks. They're just not anywhere near as good as Philly. And a large part of that is because of how good the bakeries are in Philly. The rolls in Philly are incredible.
So I need to go to Buffalo and I need to get Buffalo wings.
I think so.
That's what you're
Before
telling me?
Before you just trot out this idea that you can get Buffalo wings anywhere and they're going to be a reasonable facsimile, I think you need to go to Buffalo and have a real Buffalo wing in Buffalo.
Can I gold belly it and just get it dry ice and do it that way? All right, I'm going to do that. I'll report back. So who are the favorites?
We have them coming to our house right now. I have a gold belly bringing some Buffalo wings to my house tomorrow.
Who are the favorites in the AFC and NFC then?
So the number one seed in the NFC is indeed Philly with the cheesesteak. That's not a shocker. The number one seed in the AFC is Buffalo with the Buffalo wing. So we have Buffalo going up against Cincinnati with the chili, and we have Tennessee hot chicken up against the Kansas City barbecue. And then in the NFC, we had the Philly cheesesteak going up against LA tacos. LA was another tough one.
It's so many ways to go. Tacos was the right choice.
And then we have San Francisco going up against Green Bay, and it's going to be, unfortunately, the sourdough bread bowl up against brats and curds. I really wish it was Dallas. Brisket tacos. That's the thing.
You ruined the NFC bracket.
Tacos.
Jesus.
What do you mean? Well, the Philly cheesesteak at number one was kind of unimpeachable.
Philly's going to win anyway, regardless.
And
so
LA
it's going to come
up
down
against Arizona.
All right. Good battles ahead. Before we go, golf starts this week. You're going to be covering on Fairway Rolling all year. You're going to be doing some FanDuel same round parlays and all kinds of stuff. Are we getting Tiger? Because you and I might be at the Masters this year. I'm just going to say it now. We really could be there this year. Are we getting Tiger? Is Tiger going to walk by us with a golf club and a smile on his face?
He might walk by us with a golf club and a smile. It will not be competing in the Masters, though. He may attend. He might participate in some of the proceedings. He will not be attending the Masters as a competitor. He's just way too far away. Physically, the best estimates of when we might see him competitively that I think I agree with are at the Open Championship at St. Andrews in July. The thing that he confessed when he played with his son in December down in Orlando was he's so far away from having the stamina to walk four rounds of golf because he just has to build up. Imagine. But he has to build up that leg to be able to withstand. And the Masters especially is, as you know, is notoriously hilly. So climbing the hills is not the way that he's going to make his return to competitive golf, I don't think.
So every year there's some storyline that emerges in golf. You know, we had like the Bryson year, you had the Brooks year, et cetera, et cetera. What's 2022? What's the storyline? What's going to be the A-list storyline this year in golf?
This is it's crazy, crazy competitive. So the weird golf season starts in the fall. They have this wraparound schedule. So they start competing. The season goes, it's a 21-22 season. It goes from September till August. And the winners on tour so far have been all A-class golfers. And the reason is because there's all this pent-up demand. The Korn Ferry guys, right below the PGA Tour level guys, were not permitted to come on to tour last year. So there are going to be fewer events. Last year was a super season. They had 50 some plus events to try and accommodate all of the events that got canceled in 20 due to COVID. This year is like the return to a normal schedule. But the winners that we've had just in this calendar year, Cam Smith won in Hawaii in the Tournament of Champions. And then last week, Hideki Matsuyama, the reigning Masters winner, won in Hawaii by shooting, you know, an incredible score on the back nine. All of the guys that have won are either like top, you know, 50 guys in the world. You're not going to see long shots this year. That's my anticipation.
All right. If somebody was going to own 2022 in some way,
it's Jon Rahm.
I was going to give you Jon Rahm, Morikawa, the return of Spieth, or the return of Brooks, or Rory finally gets his shit together. Which of those? So Rahm, you think, is the most realistic of those six?
Just because of his sustained, outstanding performance over a number of years. And it felt like, you know, we might be unleashing the giant with him winning that U.S. Open the way that he did. Like, it's January, so you could say the Grand Slam is possible. The Grand Slam is in the cards for Jon Rahm. All of his finishes in majors last year were inside the top 10. I think he finished tied for fifth at the Masters. He was definitely inside the top 10 of the PGA. He won the U.S. Open, and he was, again, like fifth or sixth or seventh or eighth at the Open Championship. He's just a crazy stud. Now, I'm glad that you mentioned Morikawa. We're dying for a rivalry, somebody to get up to that Rahm level. I feel like Morikawa has the best chance. And then Victor Hovland, a lot of people love how he ended the season.
Oh, Victor.
He
won Victor with a K.
Yeah, that's right. He won at the end of last year. And a lot of folks, I've already bet him to win the Masters this upcoming season. Just because I wanted some good odds before he gets on a tear this spring.
Oh, so you have on FanDuel right now, Rahm is the Masters favorite at plus 850. Morikawa is 12-1. So you got Victor's 29-1 on FanDuel now.
Yeah, that's so why I went. That. Yes, that's why I jumped on Victor. Pure value. Guy, just a guy that can do it.
Should I bet on Tommy Fleetwood at 40-1 or set the money on fire like I have the last 4 years? What do you think? I can't quit you, Tommy Fleetwood.
We had this conversation about Hideki and entering the 2021 Masters, and his putting had been so bad, and then he went out and won it. So I'm hesitant to tell you not to bet on anybody. Do something small on Tommy, just for your heart. But we do have Bet the House coming up this entire golf season, presented by FanDuel. Thank God. Yeah. Great job, FanDuel. And for this upcoming tournament, They've already done a boost for us. We have two guys that we love in the top 20. We have Scottie Scheffler, the American who made the Ryder Cup. He was like the last guy to make the Ryder Cup. He hasn't won on tour yet. He was Rookie of the Year in 2020. He finished the top five at the PGA Championship out in San Francisco. And we have the Canadian Corey Connors, who shot 264s over the most weekend. If you bet both of those guys, it's a kind of parlay to finish inside the top 20. FanDuel is boosting that up to plus 300, 3-1 odds for two guys, both of whom can absolutely win the tournament. That's the bet the house this week.
It's a good one. I'm excited for those because I will say house only has a couple of like real talents. One is weird golf parlays. One is being able to finish whatever food is left on the table for a group dinner of more than 5-6 people. And
that's
then
true.
The other one is just your ability to drink more than one Bloody Mary, like they're like Miller Lights. I don't understand.
I
how
really
you do
love
it.
Bloody
like
Marys.
You can have what, like five Bloody Marys? Like I can drink like one and a half, and then I want to throw up. You can keep going, like they're like Long Island iced teas or something.
I don't know why it something about them feels like food to me, and I can just keep going and going. I had four
maybe that's
on,
it
on Sunday.
Yeah,
it just feels it. Like food. Yeah.
All right, so we're going to, you and I are going to do a special for my YouTube channel, which launched today. We're going to do a special story.
Congrats.
And put that, thank you. We're going to put
old guy YouTube.
Old guy YouTube. I have a chance. We looked at all the over 50 YouTube stars and I really have a chance to make an imprint. But you and I are going to do a story exclusively for that YouTube channel that I would urge people to check out. That
I'm going to have to change my clothes for this.
Okay.
I'm going to change.
House, good to see you as always. Good luck with the golf season.
Good luck with our NFL bets. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. That's it for the podcast. It was produced by Kyle Creighton. Don't forget, new YouTube channel, youtube.com/Bill Simmons. Check it out. We decided we're going to hold the house story that we were going to tell that was going to be an exclusive on that channel. That wasn't even going to be on this podcast. It was just going to be on the YouTube channel only. We're going to hold it because I want to dangle it for the perfect time when we, maybe it's for when we get to, I don't know, 200,000 subscribers or whatever. I'm going to hold it. I'm going to hold it as a carrot to try to, as we move forward down the road, 2022. So stay tuned. But we are going to be putting some exclusive stuff on there over the next few weeks and months. So youtube.com/Bill Simmons. It's cool. It's cool to see all the videos. My facial hair in different stages. When we used to have a studio, we used to have guests in the studio. Used to be able to see the people I was interviewing. So anyway, actually trying to pick some of the videos made me sad that we have been doing the podcast the way we've been doing it for 22 months now and counting. Because it was a lot more fun when everybody was in person. Hopefully we'll get back there someday. Stay safe out there. I will see you on this feed on Thursday with million dollar picks and a whole lot more. Until then.